It's Darren Winston's Book Report.
Hey, Jill.
Do you know, someone called me from the Whitney, I think, recently. And I thought, I am so happy there's still a world of museums, order, catalogs, organized information.
And telephones.
Oh, and absolutely telephones. And I mean, but that just makes me sound old. Except that I never forget that in the corridors of power, that is actually how business still gets done, is face-to-face and discussing. And I think that the media, by and large, has done a superior job brainwashing people that the best thing to do is send, you know, a screed that says, oh, whatever, and hope that it lands where you want it to. But with that in mind, you have a small, let's just say, research department of your own, you being Darren Winston, because that's something that you've always done. And I think that if you've always done it, it's just, one keeps doing it.
Yeah, it's what you do. I mean, a lot of the, every book that comes through my hands has some element of research, whether it's me quickly reminding myself what it is and writing it down in pencil in the front, or if something looks more interesting, it goes into the sort of the pile to be looked at. And if something looks extremely interesting, meaning hours worth of work, it goes into a third pile.
Now stop right there for 1 second, sure. Which may be the entire show. But how do you explain that concept to a very disposable culture? Because I often think, right, great for right this second. Do you realize that you're going to look at that and then not have any place to put it in your brain because it's going to be replaced by the next one?
I think what I do, like the sort of research I do, even though I use the internet and all sorts of modern angles come to it, when I'm done, that information will be disseminated in the way you're talking about, electronically, and it'll be sent to someone perhaps in an email, and they will look at it and digest it. The part that you can't change or can't change so quickly is the sitting down and doing the work, drawing the conclusions, it's in the simplest way, it's like a connect the dots, but there's no dots. You really have to make the picture. You have the vaguest idea. So I'll get a book, and let's say there's a name in the front, and the name doesn't mean much, but there's the name of a house. And I think, okay, well, it's probably England, and the name next to the name of the house sounds like it could be an English village or town. So I'll research the house and I'll find out a lot about the house, who owned it. Maybe one of the names will be the name in my book. Then I look at the book and I look at when the book was published, when it was owned by this person. Presumably they've dated it, and start drawing these conclusions. And I think we talked about this recently, where I had a religious text that had belonged to a very important person in the Methodist church in the 18th century, and it had somehow come down to a lady that perhaps he knew that lived in his house. She wasn't a maid, but she wasn't his wife. She had some other duty, and she might have also been connected to the church. None of that was obvious. It just looked like a messed up old book. You know, it had lots of faults, and I think I might have mentioned this. It had a brand new spine, which immediately made me think someone thought to keep this. And the way that it was repaired told me that it wasn't the sort of person who repaired their Sunday Bible so they can bring it back and forth in the car. It was someone who felt there was more import to it than that. So again, it causes you to dig deeper. Now, of course, you might dig and find nothing, or you might dig and find so many things you don't even know where to start connecting the dots.
And I think that that's where I'm asking a cultural question at this point. I used to love Connect the Dots. I used to just, that was a fun game.
Still is.
Yes, but how do you connect the dots on, part of connecting the dots, if you recall, learning to put the pen not where you wanted it. My brother used to connect the dots that way. all over the page. You know, he would just scribble, and I'd sit there and I'd say, but you can't do that. This dot goes to this dot, goes to this dot. Don't you see it's meant to be an elephant? Now, he grew up to be very successful. So, I mean, obviously there was something to scribbling all over those pages, which still offends me. But the point is that connecting those dots, actually connecting those dots, gives your mind, it opens up little passages to connect dots.
Absolutely, like a crossword puzzle.
And it's not entirely clear that we are encouraging. The first question, your automatic default connect the dots question, you know, where you make the first cut? I am encountering many people of, you know, multi-generational, but more people who have committed to a fully digital lifestyle, that they're dot connecting. They don't know where to make the first cut to ask the first question.
If you could also argue if they're even asking a question, I think, you know, part of the buying into that full digital lifestyle, and without sounding like we're slamming it, is if you don't want to do the homework, or if you don't want to read about the thing you're reading about, then you just take the sort of the sound bite. So if I'm doing all these hours of research for a book, and then I send a one paragraph description out, I've kind of produced that sound bite, but my thinking is the sound bite is like a sponge, and I'm giving it to you dry, and when you get it, you stick it back in the water, and you realize just how much it holds. Because so much of to me, and I think to my customers, the interest of the books they're buying is what they represent. Of course, it's the story, it's the design, but if this book belonged to not even a famous person so much as that just someone we can trace back in time. I bought several hundred books last year that had come from the same family, and the earliest ones dated from about 1900 and the latest ones from maybe 1930. And there was lots of exciting things about that purchase, but the most exciting thing was those books had been bought by this family at a few stores because they still had bookmarks and things in them and kept in the same family for 100 years or 100 plus years. And charting that book's journey, I think, is great. If I go into a secondhand shop and I buy a book, it might have some name and a date in the front, and I have no idea where it's been. But when I take it from its birthplace, if you will, and then send it out into the world, that's a different sort of thing. And that goes back to who owned the book, where were they living. So often you'll see, particularly in the Victorian era, inscriptions that are dated December 25th, and it says, you know, from Mama. And not only is that charming, but it lets you know that a book, first of all, a book that might be difficult to date, certainly dates from the date of the inscription, because nobody would have really backdated an inscription. But at the same time, I had a book recently that was inscribed in Latin. Couldn't read it. I could make out a few words. And I sent it to a colleague, and he translated it and sent it back. And the book dated from the very early 17th century, like 1610, let's say. And the inscription was from the 1690s. And it was basically a school prize. It was no different than, you know, your teacher giving you a book as a gift for, you know, getting straight A's in English or something. That was very popular in the early 20th century. And you see things that are often called like school prize bindings because they'll have the crest of the school on the cover. But they were doing it 300 years ago. And in a funny way, I looked at the book and I thought, this is just some kid's school book. His Latin teacher gave him this book because he was good at Latin, but he was good at Latin not long after America was discovered or before London burned. And again, you start pulling all these periods out of history and you think of your little, extremely fragile book making its way through the world, the book that could burn up in seconds, could be ruined by water, mold,
whatever. That
didn't
get consumed by the Great Fire of London.
Exactly.
That didn't sink on its way to the New World. That didn't, yes, all the things that could have happened, and it has survived, and it becomes an actual tangible item that has traveled through time.
Yeah, it's a time traveler. Like a painting, like a statue, but you know, sometimes you look at a painting and you think, okay, was it repaired? Was it overpainted? Was it cleaned?
Well, you might, but the painting tends to, by and large,
it's static.
It's where it, in many, if you're looking in a museum, And I'm assuming that people still go to music. No, but if you're looking at that sort of thing, then you're going to a place that you know has that in a lot of different cases. Or you see an exhibition where people have gathered it and it's going back. The book is more of a time traveler.
And it's more transient. You don't know it's been in cars. It's been. I remember buying a book that was an atlas, basically. But it was an atlas from the 17th century. So it was designed to go in a saddlebag, and it was sort of the exact dimensions of a saddlebag. And I remember thinking I could just put it in a saddlebag now and put it on a bicycle or a motorcycle and drive around and have this sort of modern equivalent where you had to take the atlas with you. You didn't sit at home and study it. You kind of went on archaic roads that perhaps weren't well signposted and often said, you know, the road to such and such, and it was just a straight line, and you kind of had to find the line. There was no corresponding road necessarily.
And certainly no GPS.
Years ago, I remember having a letter. It was a Jane Austen letter, which alone was exciting. It belonged to a colleague. And he brought it over to my apartment. This is before I had a shop. And we were looking at it and talking about that and some other stuff. And my, like, day's mail was on my desk. And then there was this letter from Jane Austen. And I was just struck at the sort of irony of 200 years later, you know, it's all mail. Now, this circular from Reader's Digest is never going to have the same value as this thing. And it made it very didn't take the romance out of it, but it made me think, okay, first and foremost, this was a functional thing. This was a communique, and the only way it could have been done at the time, except in person, as you mentioned. But for a few seconds, it was just a piece of mail that had traveled from, you know, 1801 to this desk in New York City. And, you know, it's one of the fun things about what we do.
It's Darren Winston's book report.
Thanks, Jill.